This is an ABC podcast.
You're listening to Pacific Pulse on ABC Radio Australia.
It's okay to show that, oh, I've got this big injury and I broke my arm, or some people can see it. Whereas people who are suffering chronic anxiety or depression, most of the time, of course, they push on and try to do the best they can, but clearly struggling.
You don't want to show weakness. You don't want to be vulnerable. You don't want to reveal parts of yourself to even just a mental health professional, somebody you've never met. It's a big barrier, sure. But once I overcame that stigma, which wasn't easy, you know, I was able to, oh, wait, so yeah, we can diagnose you with depression now.
Okay, guys, when was the last time you opened up to someone else? I mean, really opened up. There's so much weighing on our fathers, our brothers and sons today. Pressure to provide, pressure to succeed, and pressure to look good while doing it. But keeping those pressures to yourself can build up, and without the right support, it can be fatal. And a trigger warning, this episode will talk about death by suicide. Research by The Lancet in 2019 found Pacific Island nations' suicide rates were far higher than the global average of 9 deaths per 100,000. In places like Kiribati, the average was a devastating 29 deaths per 100,000. These researchers attributed the crisis to rapid social changes, Western influences, and the impacts of climate change, which is eroding cultural ties and a sense of belonging, leading to feelings of helplessness and poor mental well-being. So what are the signs to be aware of in yourself and in others? And a trigger warning, this conversation talks about suicide and mental health. I'm opening up the floor to Dr. Colin Tukui Tonga. He's an associate professor of public health at the I'm opening up the floor today to Dr. Colin Tukui Tonga. He's an associate professor of public health at the University of Auckland. And because this is a conversation about men's health, I wanted to bring in another man, our very own Nisha Daily host, Michael Chow. When we're talking about anxiety and depression among Pacific Island men in particular, what are the very key signs that you would be looking out for?
Depression, anxiety, those kinds of conditions are even more difficult to manage because of the kind of cultural stigma attached to it. The definitions aren't necessarily shared by people. And it's normal to feel a bit low on some days, but when does that low become a problem? So it's highly subjective to my low mood. I can cope with and it doesn't affect how I live, but with someone else, it can be debilitating and difficult for them to function in their relationships, their work, their family and so on. So it can be a bit of an issue just being clear about what's what. But having said all this, the World Health Organization estimates that mental disorders, mental health being problems, is the most important, most common set of disorders around the world. Say, for example, 300 million people roughly suffer from depression. But because the health sector tend to count number of people who die, it's not perceived as a problem because it doesn't, apart from suicide, appear in those kinds of statistics. And that's why it's difficult to estimate. Most people now say, of course, that mental disorders is the most common cause of poor health around the world. It's just not well understood. Women in the Pacific, for example, if they feel depression, they don't tend to say so. Men are stoic and, again, don't tend to share their issues. So that's a bit of an issue about mental disorders. But there's no doubt whatsoever it's a very common set of conditions, depression and anxiety in particular. But even more serious psychotic disorders like schizophrenia, bipolar disorders, and dementia.
Yeah, absolutely. Then, yeah, I used to be one of those men, or at least a young lad who was like, this is the wrong kind of thing. You'd be like, it's weak to think. You don't want to show weakness. You don't want to be vulnerable. You don't want to reveal parts of yourself to even just a mental health professional, somebody you've never met. It's a big barrier, sure. But once I overcame that stigma, which wasn't easy. You know, I was able to, oh, wait, so yeah, we can diagnose you with depression now because you've been depressed for a very long time. And then eventually that led to, oh, we can diagnose you with borderline personality disorder now. You've had BPD for quite a long time. And then even just recently, we can diagnose you with ADHD as well. So I've got the cocktail going. And yeah, look, mental health has been such a big part of my adult life because I want to live a nice, healthy, emotionally healthy life worth living, battling things like suicide and other heavy stuff in a very rough upbringing. Yeah, it was probably the best decision ever to really, I guess, prioritize mental health and constantly trying to show other men, Pacific Island men, or just men in general, who still have that stigma of, oh, I can't talk about my emotions, I can't do this, or I shouldn't, otherwise, oh, what will the boys think, or what will blah, blah, what will my partner think? Even just wanting to be vulnerable around, say, the person you're in a relationship with, there's still that stigma of just doing that. And yeah, it's the first barrier, and it's just such a big barrier. But once getting over that, everything got a lot easier, and also just life got a lot more enjoyable, you know.
I'm hearing about some of Michael's experiences. You've worked throughout the Pacific, and I'm conscious that in the diaspora, we probably have more means to try to get these conditions diagnosed. Are you able to paint a picture of what services look like in the Pacific today for anyone who might be thinking or experiencing depression or anxiety?
Yes, before we get to that, I should also say that the mental health services, at least in Aotearoa, is not that flash either, to be honest. We were involved in what's called an epidemiological survey of mental disorders throughout New Zealand with a quite a sizable sample of Pacific people. And at that time, we found that Pacific folk, those with severe mental disorders, psychotic illness, only half were getting care. So people with a severe mental disorder were walking around in the community pretty much on their own or with their family or with their own networks. They weren't getting professional care. And even now in 2024, we continue to have big debates about the state of mental health services in New Zealand, people not getting care that they need. So it's important to say that because when we talk about mental health disorders and mental health services in the islands, it's probably one of the most poorly funded services in the islands generally. We are currently doing a study of mental disorders and mental health services in six of the Polynesian countries funded by the New Zealand Ministry of Foreign Affairs. It's the first time we're actually attempting to get more reliable estimates of the extent of mental health problems in the region. But as I say, generally speaking, mental health disorders services are poorly funded. There's a shortage of trained mental health professionals. Most people who have a mental disorder try to cope on their own or with their family or friends or with the church. It's a pretty sad situation and not enough trained health care workers. It's also complicated by the fact that many of our island communities in the island still think about mental disorders as some kind of possession by the devil or by spirits, a strong cultural interpretations of mental disorders that it's not helpful and that it leads to stigma that we heard about earlier. So generally not a good state. Fortunately, there's increasing awareness of the extent of mental disorders and the need for better mental health services in the islands. But at the moment, it's not very good, and we're some way away from what I regard as adequate and good care.
There's really interesting points that you raised, Mr. Colin, and I think about belief systems around mental health. And when we all live together predominantly, there is a belief that that can almost protect against poor mental health.
Yeah, generally, if you're in a supportive environment, an extended family with strong ties between members of the family, strong support, it is accepted as a protective factor. In the study I referred to that we did here in New Zealand, we found that if you were born in the islands and you were 18, 19, before you came to New Zealand, you were less likely to have a mental disorder, say, compared to someone who is born and raised in New Zealand. And again, the inference there is that family, extended family, ainga, whānau, and broader networks of church and village and community are protective factors. When people come to New Zealand, they tend to not be connected as well to those wider social networks. They tend to live smaller nuclear families and no community links as much as they have had in the island. So that, generally speaking, is a factor in protecting people from mental disorders.
You're listening to Pacific Pulse on ABC Radio Australia.
I'm Melissa Makin, and I'm talking to Dr. Colin Tukuitonga, who's an Associate Professor of Public Health at the University of Auckland. I'm also joined by my fellow Nija Daily host, Michael Chow. I've seen political events like the Dawn Raids referenced as contributing factors when it comes to poor mental health, discrimination, structural issues in systems. Are you able to talk a little bit about the experience for Pacific Islanders in New Zealand?
We did a epidemiological, a survey of the common mental disorders in New Zealand back in 1986 across the whole country with a big sample of Pacific people. So the study is a bit dated now, but some other indicators since then show that things really haven't changed. That Pacific people in New Zealand experience or suffer from mental disorders slightly higher than local people, very similar to Indigenous Māori experiences. And the reason for that, of course, is some of the things you've mentioned, racism, stigmatization, unemployment, all of those sort of things that happen. And anxiety is a common disorder that's arisen out of various life events, social phobia or panic disorders. People will talk about obsessive compulsive disorders, post-traumatic stress disorders. In other words, anxiety is common and usually linked to some of life's events. The Dawn Raids, of course, was a major traumatic experience for Pacific people in New Zealand, not just for Samoans and Tongans, but even Niueans and Cook Islanders who are citizens were caught up in the raids because I guess people just felt they're all brown, so they shouldn't be here kind of thing. So that's been a traumatic chapter in the lives of Pacific people in New Zealand. There was an apology from the government some years back, but lo and behold, people were still being discriminated against in the immigration service even after the apology. So these things tend to be long-term. They tend to be lifelong and often intergenerational. Parents live in a difficult, stressful environment, running two jobs, low income, and it affects their children and so on. And so it goes. So clearly, life events are really important in the origins and emergence of mental disorders.
Yeah, for sure. And I think what Dr. Colin was also talking about was like that idea of community being important in helping one overcome the stigmas. Like we have to have these like conversations about mental health openly and normalizing the whole vulnerability amongst our people, people feeling safe to speak and also others saying, yes, this is a safe place for me to listen. And I think about like how invalidating people's mental struggles or just feelings and emotions, like that stuff really does not help. Like you might be in a family and you might talk about something and then just this simple invalidating language of someone telling you man up or be a man. Or just you have to move on. Everybody wants to move forward from struggles or past traumas, but you don't have to invalidate or the emotions or feelings in order to move on. You can validate them saying, yes, you felt this. Yes, that sucked. Yes, that was blah, blah. And you can move on. Like when I did dialectical behavior therapy for a year long stretch of my life, that was such an important skill thing they taught us was radical acceptance. It's accepting situations, traumas, anything. And it doesn't mean you're saying something was okay. It doesn't mean you wanted or allowed this to happen. It's saying it happened, and yeah, it sucked. And then knowing what radical acceptance is and inserting that into just how you might be suffering, because they even taught us like an equation about suffering. Suffering is like pain and non-acceptance equals suffering. But when you get rid of the non-acceptance and insert the radical acceptance, the suffering goes away, but the pain doesn't. That's one thing that has to be clear is, yes, you will still feel pain. That won't necessarily go away, but at least you're not suffering anymore.
I think, of course. And I think it's worth repeating what you just said about man up. We talked about it in the heart health space, but somehow it's more accepting to say I have a heart condition or I have high blood pressure or whatever. Whereas mental disorders, people are extremely reluctant to admit that they have had some mental disorders. In other words, the concern and so on is much more pronounced with mental disorders than it is with physical health. It's okay to show that, oh, I've got this big injury and I broke my arm, or some people can see it. Whereas people who are suffering chronic anxiety or depression, most of the time, of course, they push on and try to do the best they can, but clearly struggling. But people can't see anything, and they think this person is okay. And that's why there's a general view that perhaps people should take more care in your relationships with other people. You don't really know what people are going through, the stresses they have. And this idea to harden up is not very helpful. And when you're talking with people about improving mental health, it's very important to discourage people from bottling up whatever issue they have and to share their thoughts and feelings with friends, with family, with professional people, because that's a good place to start. There's a lot of racist material at the moment, very unpleasant racism promoted by some of our politicians. And so it's very important to affirm and to support our friends and family as they struggle with these things, to build your confidence broadly, and also obviously try to relax if you can. Often easier said than done, but that's something we suggest to people. And above all, if you think yourself or your family or friend is struggling, try and get some help sooner rather than later.
How do you think about it in terms of knowing when it's a problem and knowing when it's not?
Yeah, and I don't have the answer, because it's subjective. It depends on the individual, his or her family, his or her networks, etc. But generally, if someone is not able to function, they don't want to get out of bed, there's loss of energy, loss of interest, don't want to, can't sleep, can't eat. We all feel those things every so often, but you bounce back really quickly. Someone who's in that state for a longer period, you should check in on them and see if they might need some help. Someone might think about suicide, what we call ideation. That's a sign that perhaps that you should get them checked. So it's subjective. It's not like a broken arm or pneumonia or something. So you just have to be tuned in to where they are. Someone you know well, who's functioning well in relationships and work and school and all of that, becomes different, withdrawn, loss of energy, loss of interest, you should check in on them. Doesn't mean that they have anything serious, but you should at least, if you're not sure, you should check in on them. Just your point earlier about death and dying, the Maori here, indigenous people, have a wonderful tangi, we call it, a celebration of someone who's passed away. So family come together, whānau come together, and they'll be in a marae and tell stories and sing songs and say prayers, and it could go on for a few days. And people share their experiences, both good and bad, about the one who's passed on, or even just amongst families and friends. In comparison to what we call the Pākehā process of grieving, you go to a funeral home, it's just contained to the small family unit.
Mm.
It's quite contained, which I think is not helpful. In other words, in our case, our dealing with death and dying can be a good thing, where people able to express themselves, to share feelings and emotions and so on. And I think it's a good process. So we do have some of our own ways of dealing with these things, not always just the negative stuff. We do have some very good socially connected, culturally accepted processes for dealing with some of these things. The problem with mental disorders, as I keep saying, is you're second guessing. See someone who's up and about and doing their thing and happy and so on, and suddenly they commit suicide. It's very difficult to a judgment on those things. As I say, the best advice is probably to just be attuned to your family member, to yourself, to your friends, that maybe they need some help, and it won't do any harm to just gently and appropriately check in on them every so often.
It literally is black and white when I think of how white people mourn. It's so reserved. It's so held back. It's versus, I told my partner, she's white, I told her, you will be traumatized by the way Papua New Guineans deal with. We have a thing like across Papua New Guinea, there's this thing that people call a house cry, which is literally a house cry. It's literally where you all gather in a room and just cry at the top of your lungs. It's so therapeutic in a way. And anyone who walks in there who isn't, again, white people who walk in on that, they're like, Jesus, what's happening in there? But it's literally just everyone just letting go and just crying as much as they want. Mm. And it, like, I've been to a few house cries, and yeah, like, it's so, such a powerful release. Mm. That's the thing. It's that, it's a, yeah, release is so important. And I think of every white funeral or just Western style funeral I've been to, and you're all suited up and like quiet and
sunglasses
blah, blah,
on
while one person. Yeah. And it might be like, maybe there's a priest up there who's never met the loved one, but will say some words about blah, blah, and blah, 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 blah. And it's not the same as you getting to just as a community all together express just all the things that you're feeling.
We have something similar, Michael, in Niue. I was born in Niue. We have 10 days. So someone passes away, we have 10 days, 10 nights. Family, friends come to the house of the deceased every night, and you find somewhere to sleep. You share meals together. You tell stories. You say prayers. You sing hymns. You do all kinds of stuff. And you do that for 10 nights. Even after the deceased is buried, people still come to the house. So I was really interested to hear you talk about house cry. It's a very similar thing, but it's, yeah, there's crying and upset, but there's also funny stories being told. And they do that for 10 nights. And at the end of the 10 nights, they'll have a big feed, and the people are acknowledged and gifts are shared. And then people go home. At that point, usually the young women and the family have their hair cut short, and the blokes might grow a beard, for example. So there are recognized rituals that are associated with this process of grieving a loss, of the loss of a loved one, well described. Here in New Zealand, of course, it's become much more economically challenging. People have to go to work and all of that kind of stuff. So it's abbreviated and bastardized in some way. Understandable, but it's not the proper traditional way of grieving the dead.
It gives me a lot of things to think about in terms of Indigenous ways of processing things. And we wouldn't be here this many thousand years later if we didn't have really holistic communal ways of dealing with grief and difficult things. Dr. Colin Tokui Tonga is an Associate Professor of Public Health at the University of Auckland. Michael Chow is our wonderful morning's presenter of Nisha Daily. Thank you both so much for your time.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much. Nice to meet you, Michael.
Likewise.
This has been Pacific Pulse with me, Mel Makin. You can find us by searching for ABC Pacific or wherever you get your podcasts. This episode was produced on the lands of the Yagara and the Turrbal people.